If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
I'm Tony Dean, and today we'll be calling history to speak with Nathaniel Hawthorne. He'll be answering our call on his 59th birthday on July 4th, 1863. On this day, America has just fought one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War in Gettysburg. Despite having a reputation for writing on the darker aspects of humanity like sin and guilt and hypocrisy, the death toll and the destruction of the Civil War didn't cause productive reflection that would inspire him to write. Instead, it paralyzed the creativity that made Hawthorne unique. Stories like The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables were thought-provoking stories that explored the reasons people do what they do and how they might react under intense pressure of guilt or the social consequences of not following the crowd. It was no wonder that he was able to tap into this darkness, considering that his distant relative was one of the chief magistrates at the Salem witch trials. But my favorite part of speaking with Nathaniel Hawthorne is that he doesn't tell us the ending of his stories. Instead, he presents the characters and their thoughts, and then lets the reader judge a number of possible endings. As he said, it doesn't matter what you think. What matters is that you think. In his prime, Hawthorne was surrounded by a community of brilliant writers like Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Louisa May Alcott, and Herman Melville. We should all be so lucky to be surrounded by such brilliance. Yet, as of this recording, he is tired and worn by a country divided and the magnitude of the death as his country fights itself. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow history lovers and dark romantics everywhere, I give you Nathaniel Hawthorne. Hello, is that you, Mr. Hawthorne?
Yes.
Sir, I have been looking forward to this conversation all day. My name is Tony Dean, and I'm talking to you from the future in the 21st century. The device that you're holding is called a smartphone, and it allows us to speak as if we were sitting next to each other on the porch at Wayside. It also allows me to share a record of our conversation with people around the world, and I was hoping I can ask you some questions today. But before I do, I understand this is a strange introduction. Can I answer any questions that you might have first?
Well, I don't have any specific questions for you, sir. I hope that you'll forgive me if I'm more than a bit skeptical about your claims of calling from the future and so forth. It sounds like something that Poe might write, traveling through time. This sort of thing. I hope you'll understand if I'm skeptical of this.
Most definitely, but one thing is for sure, with the kind of imagination that you have based on the stories that you've put on paper and all these different themes that you've tackled, I suppose that when we finish this call, you'll probably look at this and not be surprised something like this could happen at all, because your imagination, I think, is greater than most. The first question that I wanted to ask you is that a lot of people, when they think of your stories, when they think of The Scarlet Letter and they think of The House of Seven Gables, they kind of put some of your writing in a category of they see gloom and they see mortality and they see guilt and sin and the supernatural aspects. And yet, as you look at all of the writing that you've done, your writing is all over the place. And one thing that comes to mind when I say that is there was something that you wrote called 20 Days with Julian and Little Bunny. I mean, that's quite a bit different than The Scarlet Letter. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that was actually an excerpt from a personal family diary. We keep a family diary at all times that at any point during the day, any family member can go to the diary and make entries about any of the most commonplace things that might have happened during the day. Generally, it's Sophia and I, but sometimes the children do make an entry or two. Well, this particular journal was the story that you're referring to was actually never meant to be published at all. It's from a personal journal that was kept when my son Julian was about 5 years of age, and my youngest child, Rose, had just been born, and Sophia wanted to take Rose, the baby, and her elder sister, Una, to visit her relatives near Boston. And so she left myself and my son alone. We were living in Lenox, Massachusetts at the time, in a little red farmhouse, rather isolated area. And I don't believe I'd ever been a single parent before, as it were. I was at a bit of a loss how to deal with this half-cherub, half-imp child by myself. And so we had about 3 weeks almost that Sophia and the girls were gone. And it was just a record, a daily record I kept of our adventures with the young boy. And we did all sorts of things. We would go gather the milk every day, and we would walk into town and get the mail. And Julian would have these rather fantastical sword fights with the weeds, and we would sail newspaper boats on the mill pond. And it was quite a bonding experience for a young father and his child. And as you might imagine, there was a great deal of exasperation expressed in those pages as well. So it reads rather comically. But you're quite right in your assessment that I've written many different kinds of stories. Clearly best known for the romance novels that I've written, Scarlet Letter, House of the Seven Gables. And those do, as you say, have a very gloomy atmospheres to them. But I've written all sorts of children's stories, humorous sketches, satirical articles, and lots of stories as well about our colonial history. And so I do appreciate the acknowledgement of those different tones in some of my other work.
Well, it does seem like that once you get good at something, that people just put you into a category and they say that's who you are. I had this conversation with Poe not too long ago, which was very interesting. And I found out that he was on the swim team in school. And I mean, who in our time, nobody would know something like that, because when you see Poe, you see him in a dark room with a candle that is flickering for some odd known reason, with ravens flying around and everything's black. And here's this guy having fun hanging out with his crew on the swim team. And it's just a shame to see somebody like him and like you get put into one category when you've done so much. That makes me think of when you wrote the autobiography of President Pierce, wasn't it?
The biography, yes.
This is a political piece. This couldn't be more different than this book with Julian and the bunny and you doing the Scarlet Letter. I mean, what is your range? What's next? Are you going to be writing a book on botany and astronomy and chemistry? Is that what's next?
You know, it's very interesting. More recent years with the war raging now, I've had a difficult time with my writing. I'm rather disturbed and preoccupied with what's happening in our country. And I've started several different new romances, at least three different ones that I'm sort of trying to work on. And I just can't seem to make much progress on any of them. I suppose I'm a little bit preoccupied with what's going on in the nation. And also, I'm a very private person. I don't care to speak too much about my personal health, but I have had some health issues as well that have been a bit debilitating.
Things are always a little bit different from when we are in our 50s compared to when we're in our 20s, right? You've said several things there that I'd like to address. I want to go back, first of all. You've mentioned the word romance. And as I was reading and learning about you, this concept of writing romance came up many times. And then also describing your work as dark romance. And when I think of romance, I think of Jack and Jill walking through the forest, holding hands, falling in love and getting married. And then I saw the word dark romance, and I'm not 100% sure what that means. Can you explain what that means to you?
Indeed. The word romance in the way that I am trying to employ it is not, as you say, the sense of the word as being an amorous affair between a man and a woman. The word romance is just a reimagination of the word novel. The word novel has been used in what I would call the British style of writing, which is mostly associated with the events of a story, the events of a narrative. The British writers, the English writers, many of whom I admire greatly, Sir Walter Scott among them, you think about a novel like Ivanhoe and all of the chivalric events that take place. While those are very interesting and worthwhile pieces of literature, as I have approached my work, and certainly Mr. Poe, and shortly after we started working on that, I think Melville was perhaps influenced by some of our style, I wanted to make a departure from the emphasis on the events. I was far more interested in examining the motivations of my characters through their psychology, through their passions, what was going on internally with those characters. And so because it was a more psychological approach to my stories, I wanted to find a different term that might suggest a little more imagination, a little more of the fantastical involved than just the events. The word romance seems to me a perfect term because it suggests both the actual events that are going on, but also a romantic or fantastical element to the work as well. And so I use the term romance not to mean an amorous story, but rather to telegraph to my readers that it's not just going to be about the external events. It's going to also be, and largely be, about the internal motivations and thoughts and feelings of the characters. I believe that that was an innovation that has been somewhat credited to Mr. Poe and myself, and later Mr. Melville, as a new innovation in literature.
So when you are writing about Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter, you could say, woman cheats on her husband, hides it, and then everybody eventually finds out. But what you're saying is you're writing all the thoughts and all the feelings and the motivations, the intent. You're writing the story of everything that happened behind the story. You're like trying to spend all your time in the subtext. Is that what you're saying?
It's true. Certainly in any of the novels written by any of the great authors, English or American, you will find the occasional reference to he thought this or they felt that. But I think in much of my work, and certainly Mr. Poe's, who writes in the first person even more than I do, you will find that certainly in The Scarlet Letter, we are constantly hearing about what Hester is feeling from one moment to another, what she is thinking, how she is in her mind, how she is interpreting what is happening to her. So it's not just what is said and done, but what is felt. And I find that to be far more fascinating.
Did the works that you wrote in first person do better than the works that you didn't write in that format?
Well, most of my work is written in rather an omniscient voice, so it would be third person mostly. I enjoy the other format, but I think because it's sort of like a theatrical director. If you're on the outside, you have a wide scope of vision, and you can talk about how all of the characters feel from the inside. When you're speaking from the first person, you can only observe what that single person is thinking and feeling. And so I generally write in a rather omniscient third-person voice, although there are several of my short stories, to be sure, that are written from a sort of unnamed narrator's point of view. Generally, people realize it's a very thinly veiled interpretation of my own thoughts.
You've mentioned Mr. Poe several times, and he certainly spent some of his time writing critiques of other people's work. Have you spent time doing that as well?
I'm far more interested in my own writing, and the critics. I have mixed feelings about the critics. I will tell you a funny story about Mr. Poe. You know, he's an odd bird, that Poe. He actually wrote a review of one of my works. He wrote a review of my first collection of short stories called Twice Told Tales. And I'm sorry to say I never met Mr. Poe, never got to shake his hand. But people often ask if we were associates or friends because our writing is very similar in style and nature. I did write Mr. Poe a letter or two expressing my admiration of his craft, but this review he wrote was a very interesting piece of criticism. He started off sort of praising my work and being very complimentary, and then he sort of digressed into intimations that I might have plagiarized a tale or two and that my subjects were not varied enough, that I was, if you can believe this coming from Poe, that I was too melancholy in my tone. He's a total contradiction, that man. But it's impossible not to read his work and be entirely impressed. I mean, he is quite a genius in his craft.
I suppose you could say that it's an honor to be just critiqued by him.
It's an interesting experience, to be sure.
Okay. When you had said that he's a contradiction, a lot of people say that about your stories. Sometimes they'll get to the end, and it appears you as the author are trying to make a point, but it might be both points. Or maybe you're just trying to leave it up to the audience. Is this something that you were intentionally doing?
It's true. One of my favorite tools to use as a writer is ambiguity, or leaving the reader uncertain. I often say, what fun is giving you one ending when I can give you two possible options or more? To me, in the end, it doesn't really matter what you think. It only matters that you think. And so, yes, I think it's great fun to leave the audience to make up their own minds about the meaning or the interpretation of an ending or even of a whole tale. One of my more famous short stories is a tale called The Minister's Black Veil. And it's about this Puritan minister who wears this black veil over his face through his entire lifetime. And it confuses his congregation. And several people plead with him to let us know the meaning behind this. Why are you wearing this? Why won't you allow us to see your face and at least tell us what your reasoning is? And he never reveals his reason for this black veil. And on his deathbed, one of his associates goes to reveal it, saying, with your dying breath, at least tell us what it is. And he catches his friend's hand and he refuses to let him remove the veil. And you never learn in the tale what the reason is for him wearing it. And so I leave it up to my readers to read into the rest of the story and make their own conclusions about why might this man, who is trying to lead a noble life, a holy life, to be a supportive shepherd of his flock, why would he wear this throughout his life? And I just find it very interesting, the diverse reasons that people might come up with. It resonates with different people in different ways. And so if I can offer questions for my readers, I don't necessarily need to give them the answers. They can provide the answers for themselves.
After speaking with so many writers, and I write a little bit myself, one thing that appears to be consistent is that oftentimes when a writer is writing, their character will do something and the writer will sit back and say, well, I didn't know he was going to do that. I'm sure, I imagine you probably relate to what I'm talking about. And so that raises the question in this instance of the minister's black veil. Do you know why he didn't raise the veil?
Well, it has been speculated that the tale was based upon a real life minister who wore something similar throughout much of his life before his congregation. And I have never admitted to basing the story on that real life incident, nor will I admit to that here. He was suspected of having, this real life minister was suspected of having killed a friend in a quarrel early in his youth, and this was his penance for that act. And so, again, I leave it to my readers to examine in their own lives what it is that they may be ashamed of, what they may be repentant for in their lives.
Why they might do the same thing.
Indeed.
So a writer, in my opinion, writes what they know. And as I look at you seeing both sides of, maybe seeing many sides of a story like this, I'm wondering if that's how you feel about a lot of the things that you're dealing with. So, I mean, right now, if my timing is right, you're right in the middle of war in the United States, and there's the issue of slavery that is still being dealt with. Do you find on a lot of these difficult issues that you find yourself on both sides?
It's a very fair question. And as I have said earlier, I have been very disturbed by this war between our states and how it's tearing the fabric of our country apart. I find it very regrettable. And yet I have sympathies on both sides. I am a fairly devout Jacksonian Democrat, by which I mean that I believe very strongly in things like the expansion of the country, manifest destiny, and particularly states' rights, the right of the states to decide issues of their own personal economy and traditions and their local lifestyles for themselves. Because I, as a Northerner, and particularly as a New Englander, have a completely different lifestyle than someone in the middle states or certainly in the southern states. At that same time, that's not to intimate that I'm somehow pro-slavery. I recognize that it is a deeply immoral issue, but I also consider national unity at least as important an issue. And I think a majority of Northerners here may feel the same way. Now, I know that I certainly have a number of associates who are staunch abolitionists. Thoreau, to be sure, we've discovered that we cannot speak on the topic of abolition because the man will never stop. And he certainly tries to convert me every time we broach the subject, but I now avoid it. Just last year, I published an article about the war called Chiefly About War Matters. And it was chiefly about war matters.
It's a perfect title.
I wanted to see the effects of the war for myself sort of a little more closely. And so I traveled to Washington, D.C. I met with some of the generals of our Union Army, and ultimately I also met with President Lincoln. And I suppose that they thought, and most of my Northern friends thought, and certainly my publisher thought, that I might write an article that was very pro-Union and pro-Lincoln, and it was not that. I did not write that. I wrote what I felt, which was I decried the war in general, which is not such a popular opinion here in the North. It's, in fact, it's a rare opinion in the North. And I expressed some sympathy for the Southern states. And in particular, I wrote some less than flattering descriptions of President Lincoln. I found him to be an affable man, very amiable, certain wisdom to him, but he was also extremely homely man, very rustic in his manners, a total lack of refinement, and a sort of backwoods character to the man that was disarming for someone who is the leader of our nation. I certainly think that the man has there's a slyness to him. There's a sort of clever, what I would call a cunning to Lincoln.
Dishonest cunning?
No, sir. No, sir, not at all. I would say a man who has wisdom, but in a disarming way, because of his rustic manner, one would not assume that the man is very intelligent. And yet behind those sort of deep-set eyes there's a slyness, there's a wisdom there. He's the kind of leader who would not make a full bull run frontal assault on an enemy. He would be much more clever than that. He would sneak around to the flank and attack from the sides or behind them. This is what I mean by that. And this is not the kind of thing that you would expect from the man when you meet him, who tells endless stories and anecdotes and is completely without refinement. Forgive me, but he is.
As you're describing him, the word that was in my head, I just kept hearing the word sly, and then eventually you did say that word describing him. So as you're talking about Lincoln, I'm surprised that you didn't write something flattering, because my understanding of Lincoln is that he is not the guy that does the full frontal assault, as you've said. He's more of the guy that tries to find a way to get something done creatively, using cunning, as you've said. But also, it seems that Lincoln was, as you were, about unity being his primary goal above anything else, to keep the nation together, which seems like that is something that was important to you. So you've got a leader that is honest and wise and cunning and about the unity of the country. I guess what I'm wondering, what else would you be looking for? It sounds like that's exactly what you'd be looking for.
Well, I take exception to the fact that you said that I didn't write something flattering about him. My editor asked me to edit out some of my descriptions of the president when I felt that the descriptions that I made were among the most honest and well-crafted parts of my article. I did, in fact, give Lincoln a great deal of credit and wound up at the very end of my description, summarizing the fact that I had a good deal of fondness for Mr. Lincoln and respect for him, and found him to be as good a man in the job as any that could have been chosen for the job. It's simply the more physical attributes and the sort of rustic descriptions that I made of the president that seemed to jar both my editors and upset some of my northern readers.
I see. So if you had been walking along and Lincoln wasn't the president and you saw him shoveling manure, just based on his demeanor, that wouldn't have surprised you. He would have fit there just as well as anywhere else.
And I think Mr. Lincoln might be the first person to agree with that as well.
Okay. So about the war, I find it interesting when you were talking about states' rights, and it makes a lot of sense, where the rules for the North, which are not reliant on growing things as much as they are in the South, it really doesn't make a lot of sense for the rules to be the same in the South and the North. And yet you have this complex issue of slavery. You also don't want to make human beings property. And so it certainly is a complex issue. But I guess what I'm wondering is that you're saying that you're against the war. At least I think that's what you're saying. What is the other option if the two sides don't agree? Is the option for the Union to split?
Well, I think you have in our Congress and in our Union just prior to the secession, you have a nation full of the brightest minds, and no one seemed to be able to come up with a more efficient answer than secession. There was the Missouri Compromise. I don't know if your listeners know much about that old statute, but it was a law on the books that limited slavery in the new U.S. territories. As we expanded west, slavery was not allowed in most of the parts of the Louisiana Purchase. Well, when my dear friend Franklin Pierce, who is also a Jacksonian Democrat and also believes very strongly in states' rights, went into office and became president, he repealed the Missouri Compromise, and he signed a law called the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which allowed slavery to be determined by the popular sovereignty or the local vote of each state. He also did allow renewed enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act for those states that did have slavery as an institution in their states. And these policies, I'm sure, in some effect, did sort of bring our country a little further down the road of war.
Do you think that Pierce was a good president?
I believe that Pierce is a good man. And I believe that he was the man for the job at the time. That is the argument that I made in my campaign biography of him. I believe that he is a good man with a good heart. I agree with most of his political philosophies. And I believe what he believed, which is that the institution of slavery, while very regrettable, is not an institution that was able to be remedied by what I call human contrivances. As you said earlier, it is not an easy question to be answered. And so both the Democrats and the Whigs, for a great long period of time, sort of tacitly agreed that slavery was not an ideological issue that should be tackled, that somehow it would work itself out and it would simply no longer be an issue eventually. And this was the policy that was taken both by the Democrats and the Whigs for a great deal of time. And I believe that when Pierce came into office, his intention was to keep that policy going, which is to allow states to choose for themselves what was best for their particular state, their particular locality, and not to have the federal government make a blanket policy one way or the other.
Some have said that the biography that you wrote about him played a large role in him being elected, but then have also said that you being his friend, I understand going to college with him, that you left out some important details that the people needed to know, like he was an alcoholic and lacked courage. What would you say about that?
Well, who is to judge who is an alcoholic? Certainly, Pierce likes his drink, and I do not judge my friends based upon their own particular habits or weaknesses. He has been accused of having a drinking problem, and I simply chose not to address that at all because I don't feel that it has clouded his political integrity at all. And that is what the book was about, his fitness to be president. My brother-in-law, Horace Mann, who is a staunch abolitionist as well, he was furious at the campaign biography I wrote and said, how can you write this about this man who is pro-slavery and that he is the right man for the job and so forth? And I had other friends say, if you try to make this Pierce out to be a great man, it'll be a ridiculous thing. Well, I never say in the biography that he's a great man. I say that he is the man for the job. And I do believe that.
So you and President Pierce went to college together. And didn't you go to college with some other people that would become big name writers?
Certainly, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was in my class, yes. And also Horatio Bridge, was in our class as well. So yes, there were several men who became luminaries in their fields.
Do you think that it was just luck that somebody like you would grow up, whether we're talking about in college or we're talking about when you were living near Emerson and Thoreau? You were around so many of these brilliant people of this time. I think you even spent some time near Louisa Alcott. Is that her name?
Louisa May Alcott, yes. And her father, Bronson, sold us the wayside, sold us the house. We live next door to them.
Did you benefit from these people being around you? Did you benefit from being around them? Who was the big influence of this circle?
I think certainly Emerson was the one who everyone seemed to worship. I have my own opinions about Emerson. We became sort of friendly rivals as opposed to friends. I was certainly much closer and more comfortable with Thoreau. But I think there was, as you say, there was a community of writers. Margaret Fuller was with us as well. And I think that there was a spirit among all of us to sort of talk about literature and talk about the great lofty ideas and often have debates. As I say, Thoreau and I, we had a few debates about slavery and abolitionism, and we found we couldn't speak about that anymore. But I think the community and the spirit of Concord was one that was very symbiotic for the authors. We supported each other's pursuits, whether we had the same ideals or not. It's very interesting. People sometimes wish to group me in with the Transcendentalists, and I understand a part of that because I did very briefly take part in a Transcendentalist commune experiment called Brook Farm. It was actually experiences I had at Brook Farm actually were the basis of my third novel, The Blithedale Romance. But it was very short-lived, and I found the sort of blind optimism of the Transcendentalists to not suit my own character or viewpoints. And that is when I broke off and began to write in my own, to use your term, a darker way, focusing on the more gloomy elements of the human psyche. As you say, the sin and guilt and judgment and evil.
All the things that, if we're being honest, people find interesting.
Well, as with the issue of slavery or anything else, I see both sides, the light and the dark. I certainly admire the gifts of Emerson and Thoreau, but I find the shadow side of our nature to be more interesting, at least in terms of my own writing.
Why do you write?
Why do I write? Well, it's interesting. I've often said that because of my private nature, it's one of the reasons that I was likely drawn to writing as a career. It's a very solitary profession, perhaps the most solitary profession that there is. You don't have to deal with anybody but your own thoughts and imagination and the characters in your mind. I'm a terribly private person, reclusive. I've been called misanthropic, and I would likely agree with all of those adjectives. Painfully shy as a child and even into adulthood. And I think one of the reasons why I was drawn to writing was that it was a way to be with people that I was comfortable with, that I created in my own head and did not have to interact with other, say, real personalities. Also, I think that as a child, I was rather smothered and sequestered by my mother and my sisters. My father, Nathaniel Sr., was a ship captain, and unfortunately, he died of yellow fever in the West Indies when I was 4 years of age. He was on a voyage, and I never knew him. And so, being the only boy in my family, I had two sisters. My mother and my sisters were very protective of me, and it was a rather sheltered childhood. I was certainly not particularly athletic. I was injured in a bat and ball accident when I was very young and sort of injured my leg rather badly and stayed for most of the next 5 or 6 years in my room in this house that I referred to as Castle Dismal in Salem.
You just disappeared? You just decided you're not going to go outside anymore? You have an injured leg? Was it broken? Did the doctors do something about it?
After it healed, they could not find anything further wrong with me. Although I think I just retreated. I retreated after that accident, and certainly probably even before. I was not a very gregarious child, which is one of the things that I liked so much about Pierce. Was he was an extremely outgoing, gregarious, charming man, and I think he helped to bring that side out in me when I did eventually leave Salem and attend college in Maine. But yes, for all of those years, nearly a decade in total, I was largely sequestered away, and I preferred it that way. And so I suppose writing was my way to employ my imagination with all sorts of fantasy characters of my own making.
So I want to go back for a minute. You had mentioned Brook Farm, this commune. This seems like a strange place for you to end up. And did you invest some money in this? What did it look like? What were you doing there? What were you expecting, and what actually happened?
I did, in fact, invest some money. I invested $1,000, which was no small investment at the time. And it was not because, as I mentioned before, I never truly agreed with all of the philosophies of the Transcendentalist movement. In fact, Sophia was much more attracted to the philosophies than I was, but saw it as an opportunity to earn a lot of money in a short period of time so that I could marry Sophia. It was actually a money-making venture. And out on the farm, everybody was assigned certain duties. At first, in my enthusiasm for the new surroundings, I enjoyed the manual work. That did not last very long. That enthusiasm died fairly quickly when I was assigned to be the shoveler of manure in a large pile, a large area that they referred to as the gold mine. And it did not take long for me to weary of that and realize that between the philosophy itself, which I had not ever truly espoused myself, and the rather grueling manual labor, I left in November of that same year.
You know, when they called that pile the gold mine, to me, that sounds like good writing, because what people accuse you of doing for Franklin Pierce is what they did to make shoveling manure sound like it was a good job.
Take a bit of exception about what you say about Pierce, but I appreciate the analogy.
So how many months did you actually stay there?
It was March or April to November, so 6 or 7 months.
Oh, I see. And then it just wasn't your thing. So what's the year right now and the day?
Today is actually the 4th of July. It's 1863. Today happens to be my birthday. And yes, we are squarely in the thick of the Civil War.
Nathaniel Hawthorne's connection to the Salem witch trials almost guaranteed that his most popular works would take place during that time. And yet, he was not all doom and gloom. He wrote children's stories, satire, and even wrote the biography that might have elected a president. Despite being able to write nearly anything, in the next episode, he'll talk about the current state of events that have stifled his creativity. He'll also talk about his relationship with the writer of Moby Dick, Herman Melville, and the inspiration for some of his darkest stories. I'm glad you're enjoying this podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe now, and we'll see you at the next episode of the Calling History Podcast with part 2 of Nathaniel Hawthorne.